here we go again. Election season. It would be remiss seeing that we are filling the late Don Young's seat if I didn't introduce somebody who was very close not only to the congressman, but to Senator Ted Stevens and Murkowski, who is the first executive director of the Kenai Chamber of Commerce. Please, let's give a great big round of applause to Peggy Arness, our homesteader, our former staff person, our congressional delegation. That being said, these formats have been designed to be different from town hall meetings and from sound bites or radio talk show interviews. Okay, the questions have all been submitted by chamber members because these are the people who will have direct impact by what is done in government. And their concerns are for answers of substance. So we will be starting all of these series of candidate debates because it's brand new for everybody. Even Peggy Arness has never done ranked choice voting before. But rather than going into that issue or trying to explain strategies, I'm simply going to tell you the ballot that this race and what you will be seeing when you go to get that ballot or vote absentee. It's a federal ballot, and you will have two ballots in August to fill out. There is one where you will vote for one, and that is the people we have here today, along with Sarah Palin and Tara Sweeney and 18 others. From that ballot, you will vote for one of them. Now, that is to go on to fill the two-year seat that will be occupied after the temporary seat. You will also have on that ballot a ranked choice where you will have three candidates that you may rank. That'll be Nick Begich, Sarah Palin, and Mary Peltola. Two of them are with us here today. You will be able to rank them or not. It'll be your choice, but that's the ballot. And it's not as difficult as it really seems. It's confusing when we start comparing all of the other races and strategies and what ifs. But in this race, that's what you'll be voting for. So with that, our rules of engagement are 2-minute introductory remarks, and then we'll go to the series of questions with 60-second responses. We have our timekeeper. Wave her hand back there, yes. We got two timekeepers, all right. We'll have a 15-second, show them the 15-second yellow. Okay, and that means we'd like you to start concluding your 60-second response. And again, we hope that your answers will be very substantive and not just campaign rhetoric, because these people will be affected very much by the job that you are applying for. And then when the stop sign comes up, show us the stop sign, that means I can be very rude and interrupt you. Okay, and I will. Okay. So with that, let's start out with Nick Begich and your 2-minute opening remark, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Nick Begich III. I am from the state of Alaska, as you probably would guess. My parents split up when I was young, and I grew up, I ended up down in Florida with my grandparents on my mom's side. So a lot of times I get a question, how in the world does a Begich become a Republican? And it's a valid question, but I was raised conservative, raised Republican, went to Christian school K through 12, and ended up at Baylor University, where I got a business degree with a focus in entrepreneurship. From there, I worked in investor relations for a publicly traded company as an interface between executive management and Wall Street analysts, and asked my girlfriend's dad if we could get married, and he said no. He said, you're gonna have to get your master's degree before you marry my daughter. And I said, all right, challenge accepted. Now, I don't think he thought I was gonna do it, but I went back and got my MBA from Indiana University with a focus in IT and decision sciences. Worked at Ford Motor Company in Dearborn, Michigan. And in case you're wondering, we did get married. And my lovely wife, Darna, is here with us today. Thank you, babe, for being here. And we decided there were better places to live in the nation than the Detroit area and decided to give Alaska a try. We thought we'd be here for 2 years, and that was about 20 years ago. And I think probably that's a story that's similar to yours or those that came before you. Alaska has a way of pulling you in. But what we also know about Alaska is that there's great promise here. There's great opportunity in the state of Alaska. And I think that for those of us who have been here for many years, we choose the state of Alaska because in part of that opportunity. I want to see us have generational opportunities in the state of Alaska. I want to see us open up the state of Alaska, whether it be oil and gas or coal, resource development of all kinds in the mineral sector, fishing, sustainable fishing, timber, tourism. We have so much opportunity in the state, but only if we can make an effective business case for Alaska down in D.C. I want to do that for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. And our next candidate is Mary Peltola. Mary, 2 minutes to open, please.
Okay, thank you. Gasrunga Yupigo Mambrismi. I said my Yupik name is Agasok. It means the one who rolled. It's a very common name. I don't know why that is a name, but it is very common for both genders. I am a Yupik Eskimo from Bethel. I would love to serve you in U.S. Congress, not just for rural people, not just for Native people, not just for women, but really all Alaskans from all portions of the state. I served in the state legislature for 10 years. I had very good working relationships across party lines. I worked very well with, you all know Gary Davis. When I came into office, he was there. Hal Smalley, we were freshmen at the same time, along with Lisa Murkowski and many others. And I worked very well with Mike Chenault as well when he was the Speaker of our House for many years. I have been involved in salmon management the last 5 years on the Kuskokwim. I don't need to tell anyone here about the sad returns on king salmon. And it is, you know, that really is a part of our identity as Alaskans, and it is starting to feel like the end of an era, and I would really love to work on salmon issues in terms of reauthorization of Magnuson-Stevens Act to account for this new paradigm that we're in across the state. We have now seen chum salmon fall off the chart. And I don't in any way want to talk about, you know, one user group or another. Salmon are a common resource in Alaska. They're meaningful to everyone in Alaska, so as well as all of our marine resources. I am pro-development. I do think that responsible development should happen as long as there is social license to operate from the people who live closest to that project. I believe in jobs that provide meaningful and livable wages. I'm pro-family, pro-jobs, pro-fish, and pro-choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. We're going to alternate back and forth taking the questions. First, I'm going to let you go first with the first question.
Okay,
and that is, it seems that there is a severe housing shortage and a lack of available people in the workforce that is significantly impacting businesses' ability to grow their revenue. Businesses are closing because of the lack of workforce. How do you plan to address this issue in Congress?
I think we've got to get serious about 13th grade. We have a real problem with dropouts across the state, and even the kids who are able to make it through and get their high school diploma, it's a challenge for them to find their niche in the workforce. We have a real problem with any project, anything. People are showing up without soft skills, not understanding how what we collectively think of as a work ethic, showing up on time, ready to work, putting in a full day's work. I think that in Alaska, we have over $1 billion education budget, and not much is coming out of that budget. I think the feds, and I know this is a state issue in terms of education, but I would like to work at the federal level on really looking at education issues and making sure that young people are ready to enter the workforce when it's time for them to enter the workforce. That's one issue. And I think, there's not enough time really to talk about housing. Sorry about that.
Okay, thank you. Nick, same question. We're familiar with the issue. We want to know, what would you do as a congressman to address the lack of workforce?
Yeah, so I think what we have to start with the demographic changes that are going on in the country right now. We have an aging workforce, and you're seeing a lot of folks, particularly over the last 2 years, taking early retirements and kind of exiting the workforce either in full or in part. So that is a big part of the underlying root cause of why we're seeing workforce reductions and labor force participation reductions. We also saw a number of instances in which the federal government over the last 2 years incentivized people not to work. And we've got work as a habit, and we've got to get back into the habit of doing work. I do agree with Mary's point that we need to make sure that those who are graduating from our high schools are prepared to enter the workforce or prepared to enter that next phase of education, whatever that may be, vocational or traditional collegiate. You talk about the housing shortage. You know, one of the challenges that we have is that we've got inflation. And inflation is driving so much of the inability for people to enter starter homes. And so when you have, you know, I see I'm out of time, but inflation is a fundamental factor driving that.
Thank you. And if anyone else has a hot cell phone, please turn it down so we don't get interrupted like that. It throws the candidate off their answer, and just please silence your cell phones. Next question, and Nick, you go first on this one. Do you support legislation to ban members of Congress and their immediate family from trading individual stocks?
100% yes. And I will tell you, whether it's inside information or even public information that they're trading on, it's wrong in my view, because the member has the ability then to go forward and influence the policies that would benefit or harm those individual companies. And, you know, we need to make sure that we have the highest possible standards for the people that we elect to the Congress and throughout the country. And we can't have the level of confidence necessary in our representatives if we are questioning whether the stock trades that they're making have something to do with the legislation that they're choosing to pass or reject in the Congress.
And Ms. Veltola, the same question. Legislation to ban members of Congress and their immediate family from trading individual stocks?
I agree with banning members of Congress from trading, buying and selling stocks with insider knowledge, as well as their family members. And I think that it's important to also perhaps look at maybe beyond immediate family. I don't know how that would necessarily be done, but I think campaign finance is a very serious thing, and making sure that elected officials are disclosing their assets and portfolios. It is more complicated if you are part of a retirement system or have investors, and you those investments might be blind. I think that's acceptable if the legislator doesn't have knowledge or information about an investment account and what is happening there. That has been an issue in the state legislature, and I think that you know, penalizing people for what their investors are doing without their knowledge is a bit too far, but I do think there should be sideboards. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Hold on to the microphone, and if you bring it a little closer to your mouth,
sure.
For those of us who are hard of hearing, we'll hear you better out here.
Okay,
the question next is, inflation and cost of gas, as a member of Congress, what measures would you take, and how will you move them forward with just one vote?
Well, I think there are so many facets to inflation right now, but you know, I think most people know that the large oil and gas companies are making a killing right now. I think a lot of companies are trying to recoup costs that they lost during the pandemic. I do think that we should be investigating those companies and not allowing that, and making sure that we're clawing back any profits that they're making in this really predatory way, and then returning those to American people by way of dividends in terms of, and I think that the child tax credit showed us that the IRS can be, and the federal government can be very efficient in redistribution of issues like this. So that's one of the pieces of inflation. I think another piece is that the supply is not keeping up with demand on so many issues, and these computer chips, and part of the reason Nancy Pelosi went to Taiwan are the computer chips. I think that's a big piece of it as well.
Okay, thank you. Nick, the same question, the price of gas, inflation's kicking everybody. And we want to know, with just one vote in Congress, what would you do?
Well, my understanding is that the House Resources Committee is holding a seat for the one vacated by the late Congressman Don Young. I think that when you're just one vote, you can do most of the work through the committee process. I think that's a critical part of ensuring that the right amendments are going through must-pass legislation like the NDAA or the Farm Bill or the reconciliation bills. These can be ways that you can actually move meaningful legislation. I think what we've got to do, though, demonstrably, is we've got to open up more areas for leasing. You know, the Biden administration has sort of, by all accounts, declared war on energy. And it's a very strange policy that they are advancing with Democratic support. But we've got to open up more lands for leasing. We've got to open up Anwar. We've got to open up the ConocoPhillips Willow Project. These are things that can help us today. They can help us in the future to avoid these kinds of challenges. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we've got to let the market forces work. And right now, the market forces are not being permitted to operate because of the Biden administration's war on domestic energy.
Thank you. And Nick, first on this next question, if elected, who are you likely to support for Speaker of the House?
Well, you know, if elected, there won't be an election for Speaker of the House because this is the special election, and so the Speaker will remain Nancy Pelosi for now. If I win the subsequent election, you know, we'll have to see who runs for Speaker. And right now, the only name on our side of the aisle is McCarthy, and we'll see where he ends up.
And Mary, the same question. I'm sure they're speaking about subsequently, if you were to win the two-year term, who would you support for speaker?
You know, these are really tough questions. And one of the things I get accused of is being in lockstep with the Democratic Party. I've been living in Bethel, Alaska for the last 14 years, 75 miles off the coast of the Bering Sea. So I'm not a DC insider. It is yet to be determined who will have the majority. And I'm not sure if the Democrats have the majority, I'm not sure who's in contention for Speaker. I know that Nancy Pelosi may not be a shoo-in in that position. So I'm not comfortable making a commitment as to who I would vote for Speaker, not knowing for sure, like Nick mentioned, who's actually in contention for that position.
Okay, maybe you'll like this next question a little bit better.
Okay.
What are your top three priorities for Alaska and for the nation?
My top priority is to get the Port of Alaska funded and that project underway. That's a $1.3 to $1.6 billion project, and it's critical for all of Alaskans. The Port of Alaska, you see 75% of our goods and commodities coming through that port that are that come to Alaska by ship. I really think that that's a big part of our inflation issue, but as Alaskans, we are very, very much at the mercy of ports. I think that we've got to develop the Port of Nome and work on Arctic expansion and military security. We've got very formidable enemies with Russia and Iran talking with each other. China's a formidable enemy. So I'd like to look at military spending in Alaska and Arctic expansion. I'm also very pro-choice, and I would like to see that we codify safe and legal abortions through the legislative process.
Okay, Nick, the same issue. Top three issues on your agenda for the state and for the nation.
Right, so first for me is opening up the state of Alaska. I don't think you can represent the state if you're not pro-resource development, and again, very much pro-resource development, whether that be traditional sources of energy or the minerals necessary for this so-called new green economy, whether that be sustainable fisheries, whether that be timber or tourism. I think we've got to make a strong business case for the state of Alaska, and that's top priority for me. Secondly, I think that as we've addressed already, inflation is a huge issue, and it really in this particular case has been driven by profligate spending and a very loose monetary and fiscal policy at the federal level. We've got to get the reins back on spending, reduce the amount of accommodative policy at the Fed. You know, we got a $9 trillion balance sheet that's been blown up. And it's been the root cause for the inflation that we're experiencing right now. And I think lastly, making sure that we have the ability to speak with one another. I think that our framers knew the importance of the First Amendment, and making sure that big tech isn't putting their foot on the scale for one side of the aisle or another is really important.
Thank you. Kind of a follow-up, Nick, you can take this one first. What are the top three national security threats to the U.S.?
Well, I think one of the top national security threats that doesn't get enough coverage is that national debt. When you have over $30 trillion in national debt, and much of that national debt is owned by foreign nations, that becomes a national security threat for us. And so we're sort of creating a threat for ourselves over time by continuing to spend in the way that we do. But beyond that, I think when you look at the supply chain issues that we've been having throughout the economy in the last 18 to 24 months, a lot of that can be traced to the supply chain concentration occurring in the nation of China, right? So we have too much manufacturing of critical activity that's based in China. We've got to pivot that out of China to either domestic sources of production or at least allied sources of production. So those are two big issues. I think the third perhaps is what's happening with the aggression that we're seeing out of Russia right now. And they are pushing against the Biden administration, and they are pushing against NATO and our Western allies, and we've got to do a better job of pushing back against that sort of aggression in the 21st century.
Thank you. And Mary, the three national security threats, the top three national security threats.
So this is a bit of an odd answer, but I honestly think one of the biggest threats to the United States of America is our own partisanship. The way that we tear each other down politically, I think, is a tremendous threat, and it makes our enemies nothing but happy. Like I said, we have formidable enemies. We have real enemies. Having grown up in the Cold War, I have a very strong sense that we are living in a world now that is very much like the Cold War that I grew up in the 80s. I think that, as Nick said, the nuclear threat, the Russian aggression, I think those are very real, and I think that the tariffs that we saw with China have become a threat because we're not seeing the semiconductors and the chips, same word, we're not seeing those semiconductors being manufactured and available, and they're in everything. There are hundreds, maybe thousands in every automobile. They're in air conditioners. They're just in everything now. So I think those three are the top three.
Thank you, Mary. We got a follow-up to that question. What would your approach be as a freshman in Congress to your top priority for national security threats?
Well, I think that as Americans, every single one of us to a person has to become less partisan and less inclined to see other Americans as enemies. And this is something that I really modeled when I was in the legislature. I believe that you can't have a good working relationship with people just only interacting with them in meetings. I know for a relationship to be healthy, you've got to have 5 good interactions to every 1 bad interaction. And I really put these principles into play when I worked in the legislature, and it worked out very well for me. I was a very effective legislator despite being in the minority all those years. And I think that ultimately it's better for Alaska if we're working well with each other.
Thank you. Nick, going back to your number one threat, as a freshman congressman, what are you going to do?
Right, it's a great question. You know, I think that as a freshman, it starts with building relationships and making sure that you're constructing the right relationships, not just on one side of the aisle, but on all sides of the aisle, and making a case that, hey, you know, we do need to get spending under control. We do need to make sure that we've got a sound balance sheet and income statement as a government, right? Because continued deficit spending sends us down the same roads that we've seen time and again over history. Venezuela, Zimbabwe. Right? This is not the destiny for the United States of America. But if our leaders continue to think quarter to quarter, cycle to cycle, that's where we're going to go. You know, our adversaries, our global adversaries, they think in 10, 20, 100-year plans. That's China. And we've got to have a longer-term perspective. We've got to build relationships. That's what I intend to do in a concrete way, and continue to work through those important committees that are important not just to the state of Alaska, but to the nation as a whole.
And Mary Peltola, the next question, how should the nation address homelessness and unwanted pregnancies?
Oh, boy, you guys do not cut anybody any slack here. Unfortunately, so many issues become municipal issues, and I really applaud the folks in the room who work at the municipal level. That is the most challenging level of government, in my opinion, is at the municipal level, because the federal government is kicking things down to the state. The state has been kicking things down to the municipalities for years, and the trend seems to just keep going. Unfortunately, homelessness has become a municipal issue and a local issue. And I really think that the federal government and the state government need to step up our game to help craft solutions working with local governments. And unwanted pregnancies, again, I am a supporter of pro-choice. I think that we could go a long way in, look at the issues that we have with childcare for families that are intentionally growing their families and people intentionally with wanted children. It's very hard to find childcare and balance that out. So I didn't have enough time to fully answer the question. I'm sorry the response time is so short that it really does seem like a sound bite when you just give us 1 minute to respond. And I just am not prepared to answer things that shortly.
Just that we have a lot of questions, but we're welcome to stay afterwards and really exhaust these answers and your feelings with the people that are here. Nick, same question. It lumps two very big issues together. Nationally, how should you address homelessness and unwanted pregnancies?
Well, I do think that homelessness needs to be addressed at the local level. I don't think that's something the federal government should start getting involved in. I think that local communities have the best solutions for local people that they represent. I think when you look at the root causes of homelessness, there are many reasons why people are in that particular state, whether it be addiction issues, mental health issues. or, you know, some other family or domestic issue that has brought them to that place. You know, I don't think you can paint that entire community or that particular symptom with one broad brush and say, hey, we're going to solve the problem in one shot. It takes time, and it takes generations, unfortunately, in many respects, to resolve those issues. But we need to treat people with compassion as human beings. I think that's very important. When it comes to the nature of unwanted pregnancies, I would just say this. There are a number of people who would love to adopt. There are a number of people, children are not unwanted, right? And I think that we need to make sure we do as much as we can to increase adoption availability. I hear from many people who would love to adopt, and the process takes too long and it's too difficult.
Okay, thank you. Hold on to the mic, Nick. And this next one is yours to go first. What is your stance on the Second Amendment, right to bear arms? Do you think more gun restrictions should be in place?
No, I don't believe that we need more restrictions. You know, I think that the Second Amendment is very clear. You know, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And as someone who is a strong believer in the sanctity of the U.S. Constitution and the process thereof, we have an ability to change the Constitution should we wish to do so. But we need to honor the rule of law. And I think that when our Constitution was constructed, the framers were very intelligent people. And they said, look, let's examine the backdrop of how we became a nation in the first place. Only by having a population that had the ability to keep and bear arms were we able to succeed in that Revolutionary War and establish our nation. I think it's foundational to the country, and I continue to be a strong supporter of the Second Amendment.
Thank you. Mary, right to bear arms and more restrictions in place for gun control.
I'm a strong supporter of Second Amendment rights. I think it's funny that, or not funny, but everybody in my family is deaf in their left ear because we all are hunters. I know the hunting issue is different than the issue that you're asking about. I think that we are so far apart. One of our sides is demanding action, and the other side is saying there isn't even a definition for an assault rifle. We literally do not even have a definition for that. You can build assault rifles in parts and pieces, so it's not as though it's a simple fix to go after manufacturers. But I just think that we are so far apart on this issue, we've got to at least get definitions and folks sitting down at the table to talk about this, because we really do have an epidemic of gun violence, and I think a lot of that stems from extreme isolation, and it's exacerbated by the relationship that some people have with firearms. Anyway, thank you.
Here's a real easy one for just 60 seconds, Mary. Okay, what is your stance on illegal immigration? How are you going to fix it? In 60 seconds.
I know. Well, yeah, I'm not sure that illegal immigration is Alaska's number one issue. I think that a lot of the folks that we have living in Alaska as immigrants are here for low-paying factory jobs. I think even those jobs should really be going to Alaskans. I think that we've got to do a better job making sure that Alaskans who are already here are part of our workforce, and I don't really think that we should be importing people internationally to be taking those jobs. But I'm not sure that illegal immigration is a huge concern for most Alaskans.
And Nick, your position on illegal immigration?
So my view is, if you don't have borders, you don't have a country. It's very important that we control the migration activity that's occurring on our most southern border down in Mexico. And, you know, I think that that we've got to have stronger policies that do not encourage people to come illegally to the United States. And I think, you know, when many people arrive in the United States, there's an expectation of free education and free healthcare and job opportunities and all these things that make coming to the United States illegally very attractive for folks who are coming from nations that don't have those aspects. So I think that's really important. I do believe in a strong legal immigration policy. My wife, in fact, her parents immigrated legally to the United States from India. And they and their family have done tremendous things. They've gone on to become doctors and engineers and lawyers and investment bankers. She's a pharmacist. I'm picking on her. But I think that the story of America is an immigration story in many respects, and we need to make sure.
Got to interrupt you, Nick.
Yep. Okay.
But you can be first for the next question. Okay. What can you do in Congress to help move the AKLNG project forward?
Well, I think that we've got a tremendous opportunity with AKLNG. There's only a few short windows of historically that have opened up for us to pursue this project. I'm a very strong supporter of AKLNG because right now it financially boxes. I think in the past when it's been evaluated, maybe it didn't make as much financial sense, but right now is a unique window. We have to pursue it aggressively. I'd like to go out as part of a delegation from Alaska as one of those ambassadors with the governor and the senators and find, you know, places that we can sell this to. I mean, look what's happening in Western Europe right now. They cannot push back against Russia because they're so reliant on Russian natural gas supplies. We're their ally, and we have the supply. Let's cut a deal. Let's make this work. I believe that we can make this work, and I think it'll be good for the state of Alaska, good for the nation, and good for our international relations around the world.
Thank you. And Mary, with boots on the ground in Washington, D.C., what could you do or would you do to help move the AKLNG project?
I think there's an exciting alternative to a pipeline, and that is shipping through the Arctic. And if you look right now, Germany's having a crisis because they have counted on Russian natural gas. Obviously, that's a problem. And I think there is a unique moment right now for us where we could market it. It would be very marketable and attractive to ship our LNG through the Arctic over to Europe and provide some relief so that they're not relying on Russian natural gas.
Okay, let's stick with energy for a bit. Mary, you'll take this one first. Oil and gas leasing in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge was passed by Congress, signed by President Trump. Executive order has locked it up again. What should be done?
Well, and it is law. It was written into law into ANILCA that would be pursued, that 1002 area of ANILCA, and it's law through the budget bill. I think that it's not necessarily an economic project right now. It seems to be dying on the vine. We don't have people bidding on it. I don't think that banks are eager to invest in that because there are issues with social license to operate in terms of a whole contingency of folks worrying about the environmental impact. So I think that on its own, it is not economically attractive to producers. And I'm not sure, I'm not sure we can do anything about ANWR at this point.
Thank you. Nick, anything we can do about ANWR and getting more oil into the pipeline?
Absolutely. Let's get a new president in place. For starters, right? But I think we absolutely have to open up all areas for development and exploration. And when you talk about ANWR, I don't think we want politicians telling us what's economic and what's not economic. Let's let the private sector tell us what's economic. And they can do their exploration activity. They can go out there and determine whether that's something that they want to pursue economically. But it was a part of the deal that was sealed with the state of Alaska. We need to honor those agreements. And we'll let the private sector determine what's there and whether it's economic to pump it out of the ground. But I think it could be a tremendous opportunity for the state. Certainly, that was the belief of our past Senator Ted Stevens. He worked for decades to get that through the Senate and onto a president's desk that would sign it. Let's pursue it all the way to its final conclusion.
Okay, we're getting close to the end, but we're going to keep the questions coming. Nick, do you think the Electoral College should remain as is or have another policy to vote for the president?
I think the Electoral College is actually a genius structure. Let me explain that, because the Electoral College balances the composition of the House and the Senate. It balances states with population. And so our electors are determined by how many representatives and senators we have from each state. So Alaska has a little bit larger voice. If the Electoral College were changed in many of the ways that people would like to see it changed, we would move from three electors to one. And so I don't think we want to silence the smaller population states by changing the Electoral College. I think it's a genius construction that balances states with population.
And Mary, on the Electoral College, please.
Well, one of the interesting things for Alaska is that Alaska and Wyoming have a very large influence. Their congressman has a tremendous influence on the vote of the Electoral College because we only have one congressman from Wyoming and Alaska, so they have all of the power for that state. I do think that we definitely have the technology and the resources to go beyond using that antiquated system. I think that system has served America well for a long time when we didn't have the ability to get immediate results from ballots and ballot counting. But I think a lot of Americans are ready for a different system, especially considering we've had two different instances where the president was decided by electoral college votes rather than straight popular vote.
Okay, thank you very much. Next question, Mary. What is your stance on public education and the critical race theory?
I am a supporter of public education. The funny thing about this whole discussion of critical race theory is critical race theory is a college level class, and it's taught mostly at the legal level, like when you're getting your Juris Doctorate. So this is not something that is integrated into elementary curriculum or junior high or high school curriculum. But I am a believer in teaching history as it happened and not necessarily through the lens of the folks who won everything. I think that in a lot of states that have states' rights, we have very biased history being taught, and that's a concern to me. But I don't think that critical race theory is an issue necessarily that the federal government needs to be involved in, since that topic is taught at the college level.
Okay, thank you very much. And Mr. Begich, your stance on public education and the critical race theory.
So I think it's very important we depoliticize the classroom. I don't believe the classroom is a place for us to push one ideology or another ideology. I think we need to focus, particularly in Alaska, where our school systems are just simply not competitive with other states. You know, we've got to be focused on reading and writing and math and science and history. And I do agree we need to make sure we're teaching the truth about history. But we need to make sure we're teaching facts, right? Not ideology. And I think critical race theory, it takes us back to pre-1960. You know, it makes it pushes a perspective that racism is embedded within the human condition. And I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I believe that we can rise above those sorts of petty things and see people for who they are and the content of their character. And that's what I believe should be taught in schools today.
Final go around, and then we'll go to closing remarks. Nick takes this one first. Budget policies and the federal deficit.
Well, you know, I love this question. So I think that, you know, budgets need to be as close to balance as we can make them. You know, the typical structure for reviewing the state of a nation's balance sheet is to compare its gross domestic product, GDP, with its total outstanding debt. And right now, the United States is hovering above 130% debt to GDP ratio. That's unsustainable by any measure, certainly unsustainable at a 6% plus interest rate. And it's dangerous to the United States because it creates a self-fulfilling prophecy where you start to spin out of control. So we've got to pull that back in. You can do it through two ways, by reining in government spending, but also by growing the real economy. And we've got to do more to grow the real economy. I think that pivot of the supply chain back to the United States will help us a great deal in doing that. And so I think that's something that I'm going to continue to prioritize, is how do we make sure that those critical aspects of the supply chain are returned to domestic shores.
Thank you very much. Mary, budget policies and the federal deficit.
Well, I think we've got to take a look at the way that we tax. I happen to be in the highest paying tax bracket, and I am not a millionaire. I think that we need to remove caps on income taxes for the wealthiest people in the nation. I think that would go a long ways to addressing some of our deficit issues. And I do agree with Nick Begich in terms of growing our economy. That really is the answer at the end of the day for so many of our issues in terms, you know, making sure, I think we need to be less worried about creating affordable housing and making sure that everybody can afford housing. You know, I don't think we should be building more low-income housing. I think we should be raising income levels so that we can all afford a house to raise our families in. But I definitely think, you know, in terms of manufacturing, we've lost a lot of ground. We've gone backwards. Many of the things that America did so well, we're slipping on. So we've got to get... stops.
Thank you very much, and I personally thank you for staying on target and making your answers those with substance, and it's been a very rapid shotgun type format. With that, I'm going to give you 60 seconds for your final word, and let's start with Murray Petola.
Well, it's a real honor to be here with you today. I really appreciate the forum. It's good to have a chance to meet and talk with you directly. I am Alaskan. I was born and raised here. I have a vested interest in the state. I've got 7 kids, 4 of my own and 3 stepkids, and I've got 2 little granddaughters. One is 3 and one is a few months old. I have 2 boys who are serving in our Coast Guard. One is stationed in Oregon and one is stationed in Florida. They've both worked on going into the Coast Guard. They were both on drug interdiction and immigration patrol. Now my older son is working on rescues. He's a helicopter mechanic, and he is involved in helping direct pilots and the rescue crews when they're out doing search and rescues. So I do have a vested interest in Alaska. I think despite how diverse our state is, we all have a common future. It's in all of our best interest to work together as one, and I would love to work on your behalf in DC. Thank you.
Thank you. Nick Begich, closing remarks, please.
Well, I just think it's great that we've got 2 actual Alaskans up here. I don't know where this third candidate is, but I'd be happy to give her 30 seconds to respond, but she's not here, so we're not going to have to worry about that. Look, at the end of the day, I believe in the promise of Alaska. I believe in the capabilities of Alaskans to build a tremendous economy, to help solve so many of the problems that we're experiencing here in the state and the nation, right? We have the resources. We have the capacity. Let's unlock the potential of Alaska. I want to be that voice for you. I know there's only one voice. We've talked about it a couple of times today. There's only one voice in the Congress out of 435. That person's got to be persuasive, they've got to be articulate, they've got to be willing to show up, which is also important, right? If you want to build the kind of relationships that we need as a state, you've got to be there. I want to be that voice for you. I thank you for your consideration and your engagement in this race. Thank you very much.
And we certainly thank both of the candidates for stepping up to fill Don Young's seats. He's going to be greatly missed. But to have this quality of candidates to choose from is truly a privilege. And we applaud you for standing up and running for office. And we appreciate the system that lets us elect our local representatives. Thank you very much. Back to you.